This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is the local number. And outside Baton Rouge, please call 877-217-5757. You may reach us via email at inkstershow@wrkf.org. A year-end deadline approaching. Negotiations to avoid an economy-rattling fiscal cliff appeared at a standstill Monday. That's the story, the top story today from the Associated Press. GOP members are pressing President Obama to name a specific spending cut he will support, while the White House is insisting that the Republicans agree explicitly to raise taxes on upper incomes. And the beat goes on, as there is a division with just 3 weeks to go in 2012. And with us to talk about the so-called fiscal cliff is Robert Kahn, Senior Fellow for International Economics with the Council on Foreign Relations. Good morning to you, Dr. Kahn.
Good morning. I'm pleased to be here.
What is your assessment of where we are right now?
Well, not much different from yours in that we're less than 3 weeks out, and at least on the surface, little sign of progress, and that's worrisome. Remember, we created this cliff purposely with the idea that it would be so dire that it would force Congress and the president to get together, and while we can still hope that happens, it isn't happening yet. I think if you want to be a little bit more optimistic, the way you would think about it is that while the public positions are still extraordinarily far apart, if this deal gets done, it will be done through direct discussions between the president, Speaker Boehner, and their staffs. And at least from starting Sunday, we have news that those discussions have started and seem to be intensifying. So in that sense, hopefully things are starting to move forward. And I think the reality is probably the less that we hear about those talks, the better it is for getting a deal.
The president finished right at 5 million votes ahead of Mitt Romney, and there are votes still coming in. But right now the president is within a few thousand votes of being 5 million votes ahead. It was not a particularly close race, as it turned out. Does the president have merit when he and his followers indicate that they should have their way because the people decided on November 6th that they wanted to go in this direction?
I certainly think on the revenue issue, there's a strong feeling across both parties in Washington. The president does have a mandate. He made it very clear repeatedly during the campaign that raising the rates on the upper income earners was something he felt was critical from both a budgetary perspective and from an equity perspective. And you see already that the Republicans are splitting on that. If we're going to get a deal, though, in some ways the revenue piece, because of that, the revenue piece may be the easier piece. I think the harder deal will be on the entitlement side and on the cost-cutting side, because if he really wants to get an agreement the Republicans will help pass, there's going to have to be something material on the spending side. And there, I think, while the president has a stronger hand than before the election, I think there's still a real difference of views about how far he should go.
297-5633, if you'd like to join the conversation with Robert Kahn. He is the Senior Fellow for International Economics with the Council on Foreign Relations. A few weeks ago, in fact, right after the election, Dr. Kahn wrote that it's time for U.S. action on its fiscal problems. On December 31, an unprecedented change in U.S. policy is set to take effect. Without action, temporary spending and tax measures totaling $500 billion will expire. Given other spending and tax measures already set in train, this fiscal cliff threatens a contraction of almost 5% of the GDP in 2013, reducing the deficit by nearly half, but pushing the U.S. economy into a new recession. Is that a given that it would spark a recession?
I think almost surely. We've refined those numbers a little bit, but the basic story still holds. We're growing right now, depending on your point of view, somewhere between 2-3%. And if this kind of shock, we almost surely would have two quarters at least of negative growth, and that's the technical definition of recession. And it could be a little bit worse than that. So, yeah, we'd have a recession in the U.S. and perhaps even globally. Global growth, it's very fragile right now. Things aren't doing well in Europe. There are concerns about China, but we're still the lead engine. in global growth. And a shock that big would also, I think, be very concerning globally in terms of where's the demand going to come from.
Marcia downtown notes that Governor Jindal of Louisiana has called for an immediate balanced budget amendment. If we had to balance the budget next year, wouldn't that cause even more grief as far as wrecking the economy?
If it really were to be balanced next year, that would be an order of magnitude worse than this fiscal cliff, and it's hard to even imagine it. Most of this balanced budget ideas at least understand that it would have to take place over many years. But of course, you know, in the past we've tried to put these rules in place, and how you enforce them and what you do if you miss is always been very troubling. We had, for example, the so-called Graham-Rudman procedures back in the 80s. They didn't really work very well, and we've tried other things. So they're certainly out there, that kind of idea. It certainly would, I think, addresses that lack of confidence that, you know, the government will stand by these kind of commitments they're making. But there's really no substitute for a serious deal that puts in place a long-term framework but smooths it out over the next couple of years. You don't want to do too. It's the crash diet argument, right? We need to go on a diet. We need to lose a lot of weight. But too much too soon can be destabilizing at the same time.
What is the major aversion from the GOP about raising taxes on the top 2%? There is a proposal on the table to have tax cuts for everybody else, but the top 2%, and we're talking about those earning well over $200,000 a year. In fact, it's even higher than that as far as the average. What's the aversion to this?
Well, of course, a lot of that is simply political. Most Republicans in the Congress have never voted for a tax increase of this sort, and so they see it as a red line. There is a built-in antipathy to voting on these things on the presumption that any tax increase fuels more government spending in the future, and bigger government. I think a lot, and of course a lot of these people, particularly in the House, were elected in districts with, you know, very conservative voters, where they won with 60% of the vote on a kind of strong anti-tax platform. And so they're worried very much about primary challenges if they go that way. That said, I think what you're seeing is they understand that to be out there saying, you know, we're going to hold up a middle-class tax cut because of this 2% is politically unviable.
The situation is such that both sides are spewing a lot of political rhetoric, and that's been the case for a long time. And even during the Clinton years, when a budget amendment passed with no votes to spare and no Republicans on board in 1993, it included taxes on those best off in America, those with the most income. But it took time to balance the budget. There was about a $300 billion deficit then, and it took about 7 years for Bill Clinton to get to a balanced budget. This will take time no matter what happens. We can't expect any overnight panacea, can we?
No. I mean, and it shouldn't be tried overnight. We really want a framework that does it over 5 or 10 years. Problem is, you know, as I said before, the promises the government makes haven't been credible in this regard, and so there's a lot of discussion around town on what kind of enforcement mechanisms you could put in place so that these kind of, 10-year commitments would actually hold. But you're exactly right on the Clinton years. It did take a long time. It was supported by a strong U.S. and global growth, which better than what we have had recently. And so it was a good environment, so the wind was at their back in that sense. And so there are things that were very different then, but I do think the lesson you're drawing from it is the right one.
The Grover Norquist pledge that many of the GOP lawmakers, in fact, I think every Republican member of the Louisiana delegation has taken that oath to not raise taxes. How much of a factor is this?
It's been a very strong factor up till now, but I think that dam is breaking. It still holds a lot of Tea Party representatives, and it will make it harder for Speaker Boehner to get a bill passed. In the past, he's argued that he will only bring forward a bill that a majority of Republicans is going to support. That may have to be abandoned here because of the Norquist pledge. He may have to go forward with a bill that has a minority of Republicans, but enough Democrats still to pass it. But I think that it's going to go. There has been some talk out there about ways of allowing Congress to avoid a vote to raise taxes. And so, for example, they could let the cliff go into effect, all the taxes go up, and then they come in the next day, in essence, and vote to lower them a bit. You get the same result. I think that's such a transparent dodge that people will see through it, and I don't think that provides terribly much cover for the Norquist pledge. But they are still playing with those kind of ideas.
We're visiting with Robert Kahn of the Council on Foreign Relations. He has a BA from the University of Chicago, PhD from MIT. Now, very few members of Congress have backgrounds such as yours. In fact, very few media people do. Does that create perhaps a problem in the public at large? Is it there are so few people who really know what they're talking about?
I think there is a real disconnect in terms of how Washington talks about the deals, their economic understanding of them, and also how markets talk about the deals. And I think it sometimes makes it harder for people who are really crafting legislation to fully understand what it means for the U.S. and globally. We see this in these discussions of these fallback deals that kick the can or defer some of the decisions till February or March when the debt limit hits. From an economic perspective, a lot of those kind of compromise proposals are really quite negative. It doesn't resolve uncertainty. It leaves us fighting over these issues all the way up to the debt limit, which is a very scary problem for markets. And yet, for some in Congress, that would be a success because it navigates December 31st and the cliff. I do think there is value in talking about the economics and trying to raise the profile of that in our political debate.
You, as I stated, are the Senior Fellow for International Economics, and Dr. Kahn has worked as a senior advisor at the World Bank. How is it looking on a global scale right now?
Well, it is fragile. Global growth next year will be about 3 to 3.5%. Now, at some level, you think that's not bad, but given that some countries like China and the like report very high levels of growth, that's actually not a very good number. We often use a rule of thumb that says that if global growth is 2.5% or less, that's a global recession. That means you don't have enough dynamic demand growth to really support a strong global economy. So we're pretty close to that measure. And a major problem in the U.S. associated with the cliff would probably bring us down to that 2.5% number or lower. Why are we so close? If you look around the world, there are concerns about the momentum of growth in Asia, particularly China. Europe continues to battle their crisis, and most of us think there'll be very little growth there. And then in other parts of the world that have been doing well, some of the key emerging markets, ultimately they can't thrive if the rest of the world is struggling. And so there's not a lot of strong pockets of growth in the global economy to pick up the slack if we falter.
Well, thank you very much. Robert Kahn, Senior Fellow for International Economics with the Council on Foreign Relations. Pleasure to talk with you today, sir.
Thanks for having me on.
Take care. And coming next, we will visit with Carlos Sanchez of the NOLA.com crew. They're in force now in a big way in Baton Rouge. We'll talk more in a minute.
This is David Gordon, WRKF's general manager. We have less than 3 weeks left to raise the $70,000 needed to pay the combined quarterly bill for all NPR programs, A Prairie Home Companion, the BBC World Service, This American Life, Bob Edwards Weekend, and American Roots. You can give your tax-deductible year-end gift online at WRKF.org right now to make sure we get the money needed to get these bills paid. Thank you so much for your support.
Support for the Jim Inkster Show provided by Luba Workers' Comp. For over 20 years, Luba has provided workers' compensation coverage to businesses throughout Louisiana and now Arkansas and Mississippi. LubaWC.com. Luba Workers' Comp. Genuine dependability.
And by Taylor Clark Gallery, specializing in fine art, Audubon prints, and handmade custom framing for holiday gift giving. Taylor Clark Gallery, 2623 Government Street in Mid-City, and TaylorClark.com.
This is Jim Eagster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Kevin Gallagher producing, and our guest at this time is Carlos Sanchez with the NOAA.com crew in Baton Rouge. And, of course, this is the website for the New Orleans Times-Picayune, which is now a three-day-a-week newspaper as far as the printed version. But the website is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Good morning to you, sir.
Good morning, Jim. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, how is the change going?
I think the change is going extraordinarily well. We've got changes on two fronts. One is what you mentioned, the going from 7 days a week to 3 days a week in the print product. But for me, the bigger change is entry into the Baton Rouge market. 1 week after Election Day, we created a separate website for Baton Rouge News, and my whole mandate is to cover the Baton Rouge community.
So to get to the separate website, somebody's at their computer. If they go to NOAA.com, what happens?
You will see a direction to the top of the page where it says, make this your Baton Rouge edition, and you simply click on that, and then it becomes a Baton Rouge-centric homepage.
Now, is this a tit-for-tat thing since the Advocate has moved in with a force in New Orleans?
A lot of people like to talk about a newspaper war, but no, actually, this is something that has been in plan for well over a year. We've done a lot of market research, and we've recognized that Baton Rouge is a viable community, and we think that there is an audience that really is interested in getting their news and information almost exclusively online, and that's our objective here in Baton Rouge.
Now, the Advocate, the Picayune has always had a presence in Baton Rouge, covering the state capitol and LSU sports, but I would think that presence is now intensified. What kind of workforce do you have here now?
That presence has intensified significantly. One of my favorite things is recognizing when I first moved here to Louisiana 3 months ago, one of the first tours, obviously, is the state capitol. And of course, you go and look where Huey Long was gunned down. And I was intrigued to note that one of the most famous photographs of Huey Long after his assassination was taken by a Times-Picayune photographer. So, yes, the Times-Picayune has been here for a long time. But it's almost exclusively been to cover state government. My mandate is to cover Baton Rouge as a community. And as such, we now have a staff of 10 journalists here in the community that will be covering everything from LSU to high school sports to public safety to the council and everything else.
And you're covering the state capitol with zeal.
We remain covering the state capitol with zeal. We have two full-time legislative reporters, and we've got something in the works where we're going to get some help from the LSU Manship School to get some of their students involved in coverage as well.
Yesterday, there was a big story about hospital changes in Louisiana, and that affects everybody in the state, but it has a big effect in this area and in New Orleans. What's your take on that, and how's the coverage been as far as the Picayune being on top of the story?
Well, this is where I think a new type of coverage is to be expected. I think that the entire issue of health care in Louisiana has been an ongoing state and political issue. But where Baton Rouge may not have benefited from our coverage in the past is we'll have a better sense of how it will directly benefit this community beyond the governance boards and beyond state politics. It will be a better sense of what's going on in Baton Rouge and ultimately how it'll affect people who live here.
Do you find it curious that the people who are in state government, like the governor, who spent his entire career in the public sector, they have this opinion that the private sector can do things better? Maybe the private sector should take over the governor's office. What do you think?
That's an intriguing question. you know, it's an ongoing debate about whether the private sector can handle things, and I love the intrigue of the debate and how it's manifested itself. It began with such things as prisons, and where people really didn't have much of a constituency or an argument against it, but it quickly evolved into significant components of our community, including our public schools, where everybody has a stake, and it suddenly become a much more viable debate.
297-5633 if you'd like to talk. Carlos Sanchez of the NOLA.com crew is with us. He's based in Baton Rouge. He's a bureau chief here. But there seems to be a belief in state government here and elsewhere that whether it comes down to schools, prisons, hospitals, the private sector can always do better. And these are people, as I said, like Governor Jindal, who's never worked in the private sector except for 6 months at the McKinsey Company.
You know, that belief certainly exists. It's viable and it's been around for a while. But I think there are some downsides to that. And from a perspective of a journalist, one of the major downsides is visibility and just how much you're willing to show and take. Just yesterday, there was a story that the Associated Press ran regarding public policy planning via private emails, which limits the public's access to garner information on how this public policy was arrived at. And I think that is a major danger when we're talking about private corporations running institutions at taxpayer expense.
Well, that's another big story covered earnestly across the state today regarding the private emails and a way to dodge public exposure and public laws involving transparency. Do you think this is appropriate?
No, I think anytime you limit access to information, particularly to citizens who are, you know, footing the bill, citizens should be entitled to and should have the expectation of as much information as possible.
Well, it appears that this administration, and by the way, this is true in Washington as well with President Obama, who also pledged more transparency, and instead we've had basically a continuation of the Bush philosophy and strategy on this front. In Baton Rouge, Governor Jindal, in his first inaugural address, January 14th, 2008, he stated that ethics and transparency would be at the top, the major issue. Well, it seems that transparency is good for some folks, but maybe not good for others.
You know, and I think there's a sense, too, that with technology that government entities in particular think that they're being transparent in one respect by saying, well, we've got a website and we put this information up on the website. But really, transparency is all encompassing, and it involves the issue of debate and questioning of whether public policies that are being considered should be considered and certainly should be enacted. And I think that's where many government entities are trying to avoid or circumvent that transparency issue.
Now, Carlos is a relative newbie to this area. You spent most of your career in Texas, right?
That's correct. I was born and reared in Texas, and I've been in Louisiana for about 90 days now. I had my first bowl of jambalaya only about a month ago and certainly enjoyed it, but it is a dramatically different culture for me here in Louisiana.
And you were reared in El Paso.
That's correct. Grew up on the border, and again, a completely different culture from what I'm used to here in Baton Rouge.
When you hear politicians like, say, Senator Vitter and others, but let's talk about our junior senator, talk about tightening the borders and stemming the flow of immigrants to this country, does that get your blood boiling, or does that go with the territory?
Well, I find it always intriguing that argument is put forth, particularly given the repercussions of what happened. I mean, if you look at the last presidential election, Romney lost among Hispanic voters by a margin of 3-1, and I think it was in great measure because of that type of rhetoric. So if conservatives in particular and nativists especially want to continue to float that argument, I think they need to be aware of the repercussions.
The Hispanic vote, as you stated, went heavily for the president, and back in 2004 when President Bush won a close election, he got about 40% of the Hispanic vote.
He did indeed, and he really made an effort to reach out. I had the honor of covering Governor Bush and his ascent in state politics up to the White House, and he always understood and reached out to the Hispanic community, and I think they paid him back in kind.
You covered him closely?
I wasn't the gubernatorial reporter, but I covered the legislature at the time that he was governor. So, yes, I saw him in action.
What kind of accessibility did reporters in Austin, Texas have with Governor George Walker Bush?
That is one of the biggest contrasts that I've seen thus far. It was extreme accessibility. We had an ability, for example, any morning to stand outside the Capitol because we knew that the governor would come from the governor's mansion just about two blocks away, as it is here in Baton Rouge. Go to the same spot every day, and if we had a question, he would chat and answer our questions. You don't see that here in Baton Rouge, and that, for me, is a very stark contrast.
Why not in Baton Rouge?
I think it is, for me, in my understanding of how Bobby Jindal works, and understand I have not met the governor yet in 3 months here.
Have you tried?
I have tried. I see a very kind of cloistered governor who is in by his managers, who are very protective of him and protective of his image. And it's very hard to penetrate that veil of protection.
But if it were penetrated, he might end up benefiting.
I think that candor always benefits you. I think that is something that is refreshing to the public. And I think one of the greatest examples is began here in Louisiana with Huey Long. He was very candid in his approach, and I think people appreciated that. And I think that is something that people appreciate to this day.
Extroverts usually do better in politics than introverts, but we have some classic cases of people who are not particularly extroverted. I don't think the president is, but he's done exceptionally well. He's won two races for president by big margins. But Governor Jindal, I don't think he's an extrovert.
I don't think he's an extrovert either, but I think the public can forgive that that nature. As you point out, they have with Governor Obama. President Obama, I'm sorry. And it's as you pointed out again, he hasn't been as transparent as presidents past, but he's still gotten beyond it because of his oratory skills, I believe.
297-5633, Carlos Sanchez, the Bureau Chief in Baton Rouge for NOLA.com, which, of course, is the website for the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Wade Adams asks, how extensively will you cover Southern University?
We plan to cover Southern very aggressively. We are very proud that we have already had a sit-down with the president of Southern, and he gave us a wonderful one-on-one interview, which we published early on. I'm looking for opportunities for additional coverage, particularly in the sports arena, but also looking at the academic issues and the fiscal issues that confront every university in Louisiana these days.
Sam asks about your attempt to interview Bobby Jindal or to meet him. How hard have you tried?
You know, for me, it hasn't been as aggressive as some of my reporters. We have had a reporter who has been here for several years. We've hired a new reporter who's also going to be covering the State House. And I've made it a priority for her to try to get to meet the governor, simply because she's the one who's going to be helping in the reporting process of that. She has reached out, I would say, at least half a dozen times in the past month trying to get interviews. And anytime we write a story involving the governor, we always seek comment from the governor's office. So,
mm-hmm. Now, do you think the governor's running for president at some point?
You know, I think that he has put himself in a position where he has opened wide the options and the viability of a national run. Obviously, at any point, if he trips up or something happens in the state level that for him, he recognizes his potential to succeed is no longer viable, then he can just as easily drop out and say all along, well, I never said I was running for president.
But you've seen this movie before. You saw it in Texas with George Bush. He was elected in 94, and he ran for president in 2000, 6 years as governor of Texas. And Governor Jindal, of course, was elected in 07. And he's looking like he might run in 2016 when he will be out of office. It works out beautifully as far as a calendar for him, doesn't it?
I think it does work out beautifully, and I think he's made all the right moves so far. In many respects, I think he's one of the first out of the gates for the 2016 race, and circumstances helped him. I mean, being the head of the Republican Governors Association has given him a national bully pulpit at a time when he really needs a national bully pulpit. The question becomes, how will he handle that stage, particularly with such an intense spotlight? And you saw the Republican primary throughout this current election. That spotlight glares harsh, and there were a lot of front runners on the Republican side who stepped up, became front runners, and then dropped out because of the glare of that harsh spotlight.
Mm-hmm. The governor has some campaign skills and political skills, as we know. He was almost elected governor of Louisiana when he was 32 years old, losing a close race to Kathleen Blanco. And usually we learn a great deal about a person when they lose an election. He came back. He won a race for Congress, made possible by David Bitter's election to the Senate, by the way. And for those who say that the senator and the governor aren't on the same page, remember, the senator's election to the U.S. Senate from Congress enabled Bobby Jindal to get that congressional seat. And then he is elected governor. Governor Jindal is 2007 at the age of 35 years old. 36 years old. He wins going away twice, and now he's positioned to run for president of the United States. But there is so much that is unknown about him. He is a mystery man as far as his personal tastes, the books, the movies, the hobbies, the people. We don't know a great deal about him, do we?
No, we don't. And I think that is another testament of the introverted nature of Governor Jindal. I think you hit it correctly when you said, in a sense, that he's a tremendous policy wonk. Learning and the positions he's had and achieved at such a young age has really, I think, given him a wonderful perspective on being able to understand policy intricacies, and certainly understand the potential in the political arena. And I think he's taken full advantage of that. And I think he's gotten some breaks headed his way. For example, Vitter running and successfully getting elected to Senate, kind of paving the way on that front.
As far as running for president, though, George Bush had the advantage of his father being a president. He had the advantage of being from one of the three largest states in America. He had some skills that perhaps Bobby Jindal does not. Can you really compare the two as far as their viability as candidates?
You know, I would not draw the comparison to George W. Bush. I venture to say I might draw a comparison to Rick Perry, the successor to George W. Bush, who, again, rose to, you know, startling prominence and became a front runner for a couple of weeks before he tripped and stumbled on the national stage and kind of went back to Texas licking his wounds. I think that... you know, being on the national stage is a three-dimensional game of chess, and I think Bobby Jindal will excel at that game. The question becomes, how will people react to his presence? It's an interesting time. I think perhaps his biggest challenger would be Marco Rubio out of Florida, and for the very reason that a lot of people are suggesting Romney lost so badly this time is that the Republican Party is viewed as a white male game right now. And if you want to be more inclusive, what better way than to choose the children of immigrants who have very conservative credentials and understand the political game?
We'll return with Carlos Sanchez of the NOLA.com crew in Baton Rouge, the bureau chief for the Picayune's website. 297-5633 is your number. Back after this one-minute pause on WRKF.
You've heard the headlines. Now find out why they matter. Listen to the Diane Rehm Show for the stories behind the news. You'll hear lively, civil conversations with people in the know. The Diane Rehm Show, answers to questions you want asked. Join us weekdays.
Brought to you by Brian Harris, Porsche Audi.
Weekdays at 10 a.m. on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge.
The East Baton Rouge School System is inviting public input at a Northeast Community Forum on creating regional school attendance zones at 6 p.m. Tuesday, December 11th at Northeast High School. More information at ebrschools.org. With regular testing, early detection, and increasingly effective treatments, those with HIV can live long, productive lives. More information on local sites for AIDS testing and education materials at actagainstaids.org.
This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. A bit more time with Carlos Sanchez of the NOAA.com organization here in Baton Rouge. And I described him as a bureau chief, and Carlos has politely told me that it's not a bureau, it's a hub. What's the distinction between a bureau and a hub?
Well, the distinction, I think, is interesting, particularly for what our plans are with Baton Rouge. Bureau, it's a game of semantics, I know, but at least it's a guiding principle for us philosophically. And a bureau is a subset of main newsroom, and has been something that has been practiced in American journalism for decades. A hub for us is considered co-equals with the New Orleans newsroom. It's our attempt to kind of convey to the Baton Rouge community that you are important to us as well, and our objective is to cover you and cover you well as co-equals to the newsrooms and the resources that are available to New Orleans.
Okay. I have a listener who wants me to follow up on your statement earlier, Jeff. He asked about the statement you made that George Bush was accessible to the media in Austin, Texas, when George Walker Bush was governor of the Lone Star State. Did you say every day? He was available every day?
Well, to the extent that reporters needed him every day. You know, if there were significant issues out there, we knew where to go when he was coming into work every day. He went to the same location. It's my understanding that Jindal's entry into the Capitol here in Baton Rouge may not follow the same patterns. Now, that may be a smart security move, but ultimately it does provide some obstacles to accessibility.
Did Governor Bush issue a schedule each day?
I don't remember that he issued a schedule each day, but what I do remember that had tremendous impact, not only on the public and on the media, but on the legislature, and that is several times during legislative session, he would simply walk through the Capitol and drop in on lawmakers unannounced and just kind of chit-chat with them. That garnered him extraordinary goodwill. And as I see kind of the tensions building toward our next legislative session here in Baton Rouge between the lawmakers and the governor, that kind of goodwill may benefit Bobby Jindal significantly.
What kind of relationship did Governor Bush have with the universities in Texas? Was he close to UT at Austin?
He had tremendous good relationships, but you also have to understand that he did not have the fiscal challenges that Governor Jindal faces. So that can always create tensions and strains. But for the most part, Governor Bush had really good relationships with both flagship universities, UT Austin and Texas A&M University.
Even though he was an Ivy League graduate.
Even though he was an Ivy League, you know, perhaps that suited him better. You know, Governor Perry in Texas right now is an A&M graduate, so there's always been suspicions with Governor Perry from the UT system. So sometimes kind of being out of state or from out of state may work to your benefit.
Well, did Governor Bush go to the UT and Texas A&M football games?
He did, but he wasn't that big a sports fan in terms of football. Obviously, you know, he was once the owner of the Texas Rangers. He was the managing partner of the Rangers. And so he was known to love football, I mean baseball, and spent a lot of time on that front.
Yeah, although that's a bit different than the state university. But in Louisiana, as we know, football is it's precious to the citizenry, and that's based, or it's evidenced by NOAA.com's influence or on LSU football in particular. You've got how many people covering the Tigers?
We have two, and I think they're some of the most fantastic and hardworking sports writers around. One along as a native of Baton Rouge, Jim Kleinpeter, and the other, Randy Rosetta, who worked several years at The Advocate before coming on board with NOAA.com.
And Governor Jindal is not a particularly big football fan. In fact, I know from those who saw it, when LSU played Ole Miss in the season finale at Tiger Stadium, Governor Jindal was attending Mass at St. Aloysius. Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, good morning to you. You're on with Carlos Sanchez as we wrap up our discussion with the man who's head of the hub in Baton Rouge for NOLA.com. Hi, Phil.
Hi. Good morning, Jim. Good morning, gentlemen. My question is, I started paying attention to NOLA.com after Hurricane Katrina at some point. There was a lot of feedback and interaction with the readers online. Is NOLA.com still doing that? I mean, can people, like, you know, respond or chat or post comments on the website?
Not only can you do that, but we are actively encouraging people to do so. A part of my objective is to get the reporters to interact in the commenting section, so it's not simply a one-way conversation. We love feedback, and we love to jump into the debate and answer or ask follow-up questions regarding the stories that we do.
And that feature is available at WRKF.org as well, so if agree or disagree with some of the extraordinary comments today from Carlos Sanchez, you may let your feelings be known in another realm. Thank you, Carlos. Good to see you, and good luck to you.
Thank you, Jim.
Take care. We're joined now by David Mark, the arena editor at Politico. He's been there for over 6 years, and he is the author of Going Dirty, The Art of Negative Campaigning. Good morning to you, David.
Hey, good morning. And, you know, I'm actually at a new position now as editor-in-chief of the website Politics out in Northern California in Silicon Valley.
All right. I got you. And, in fact, I think we visited once since you had your new position. So
That's right. That's
so,
right. So it's great to be back on.
Congratulations. But what about negative campaigning? What impact did it have, if at all, in the presidential election last month?
I think this was about an average case of negative campaigning in that it was a tough contest between President Barack Obama and Mitt Romney, but it could have been a lot worse. There wasn't talk really about Mitt Romney's Mormon faith or some other issues that could have come up that would have been much more negative. But I think the Obama campaign was really quite effective in targeting Mitt Romney and turning his strengths into weaknesses, basically his self-proclaimed image as a can-do businessman, turnaround artist, and kind of make him look like a heartless outsourcer of jobs, somebody who just really wasn't very much in touch with the common person. So I think the Obama campaign really had the upper hand on negative campaigning this election cycle.
How do you explain the 5 million vote gap that is now there between the president and Mitt Romney? It was, as I've stated, not a particularly close election.
No, can be seen, I think, as a pretty handy win for President Obama, particularly because we're in such a closely divided country. Mitt Romney was not wrong when he said 47% of the voters were never going to back him. You know, the reasons he gave may have been off, but there's 47 to 48% on each side who will always vote Democratic or Republican. So it leaves a pretty small group of undecided and new people to target. So I think this is, the credit really goes to the president's campaign for turning out voters effectively, because that's how you win presidential campaigns in this day and age.
297-5633, Inkster Show at WRKF.org. If you'd like to talk with David Mark, formerly with Politico, now editor-in-chief of Politics, that's Politix, and the author of The Art of Negative Campaigning. What were the best and worst ads of the campaign?
Probably the best ads were the ones put out by the Obama team that used Romney's own voice singing America the Beautiful over a really in an off-key way and set to some faction figures about his time at Bain Capital and outsourcing of jobs, as the Obama campaign said, and that sort of thing. I think that was really the most effective ones. There was a series of ads run against the president by outside groups suggesting that maybe he had been negligent in the Benghazi situation in Libya, that he had not been taking his role as commander-in-chief seriously. I think those really backfired and were not very effective.
Well, the campaign was such that many were predicting a photo finish, a 2000 kind of race between Gore and Bush, but as it turned out, it was more like Bush and Dukakis in 1988. Did anything happen in the final days to change the inertia?
I think the outcome of this race, the contours are pretty much set months before. Back in April or May, I was predicting that unless something dramatic happened, like a scandal or war or something of that nature, really cataclysmic, that Obama was on track to win, just because the Electoral College outcome from 2008 gave him a lot of margin for error. He could afford to lose a bunch of states that he picked up in 2008 from the previous Democratic ticket and still win the election. As it turned out, Barack Obama only lost two states that he won in 4 years previously, Indiana and North Carolina. And he ended up holding on to all the other pickups like Ohio, Florida, Virginia, Colorado, and Iowa, and some of the others, which was pretty dramatic. So it was pretty clear that Obama had the upper hand, and the burden was on Mitt Romney to try and turn it around. You could argue Hurricane Sandy, in a perverse sort of way, helped the president. You hate to say that any kind of human tragedy has positive political ramifications for one candidate or another, but it really made the president look like commander-in-chief. You had Governor Chris Christie of New Jersey, a leading Republican surrogate for Mitt Romney, essentially siding with the president and not being critical and working with the president hand-in-hand on disaster relief. So that may have undercut Romney's message. And basically the campaign went just as the Obama people had planned. They knew their voter target areas, they met those targets, and their plan worked almost to precision.
We're visiting with David Mark, editor-in-chief of Politics. Now, are you based in California, David?
We are, right in Silicon Valley, in the heart of technology.
Well, yeah, I saw that San Francisco gave 83% of its votes to the president. Los Angeles was 70% to the president. And of the 5 million vote advantage that the president has over Mitt Romney in votes that are still being tabulated from November 6th, over 3 million of the votes, as far as the advantage, came from California, where the president got almost 8 million to just under 5 million for Mitt Romney. California, with its 55 electoral votes, is a big prize. But you were largely neglected, weren't you? They were kind of like Louisiana. There wasn't a whole lot of action in California other than candidates going there to raise money.
Yeah, it gets to a couple points. So that's all true, for better or worse. And one thing is California, it's really striking California because it used to be such a competitive state. After all, this is the home of President Reagan and Richard Nixon. They both came up through Republican politics in California. And even in those races, Los Angeles County was quite competitive, and even liberal San Francisco, while it went for Democrats, there were still plenty of people who voted Republicans. And now it's, as you say, it's totally lopsided the other way. And it does mean that the candidates just kind of roll into California to raise money and then go out again. Because neither side took any public financing, any public taxpayer dollars for this election, both candidates were in California more than they might have otherwise been, but it really didn't get any special attention in the campaign cycle. And it does lead to the broader question about undoing the Electoral College or changing the system somehow so that places like California and Louisiana on the other side, you might say the red side of the ledger, get some attention, because I think you would see the candidates going there and paying attention to at least part of those states if the system was changed. I don't hold out any hope that it's going to happen, but I think maybe after a few more election cycles, there'll be some push to change the Electoral College.
Well, it's curious that California only has 6% African-American population, and yet it is perhaps the most liberal state in America as far as voting patterns, and it was evidenced on November 6th. But to show how things have changed in 1976, just 36 years ago, Jimmy Carter carried Texas, a Democrat, and lost California.
It's that free. And in fact, if you look at that whole map, the 1976 map, it's almost like an inverse of what we see today, where we see the South going solidly Democratic and New England with Republicans and California Republicans. It's and the Plain States going Democratic and the Pacific Northwest going with the Republicans. It's really amazing how that's kind of turned around.
Mm-hmm. One of the demons of the Republicans that they're taking that shots at now is the governor of New Jersey, Chris Christie, who complimented the president. He had the audacity to do so in the middle of Superstorm Sandy. I see on your website you have some praise from Bill Maher to Governor Christie, saying he's a refreshing brand of, and then there's an expletive after that. Christie might be a formidable factor if he changed parties on a national level. He seems to have dug himself a big hole as far as repairing any divisions he's had with his own party.
Yeah, I think he's a pretty stalwart Republican. He's pretty conservative, but he did his job effectively as governor when the storm hit, and so he really had no choice. But the credit still goes to Christie. And my doubt about Christie have always been whether he would play nationally, whether or not that kind of blustery northeasterner and bossy type would really go over so well in places like Louisiana or Kansas or other spots. It's possible, but I'm not so sure if he would really play well nationally.
And on your website, Politics, you say, you ask the question, will you spend more or less this year than last in this holiday season? What does the information that you have received tell you?
People are watching the wallets pretty carefully. There's a lot of concern now about the fiscal cliff that is supposed to be coming up at the end of the year, where taxes may go up. And in our poll, 55% of people polled say they're going to spend less than the year before. So I think people still feel, even though the recession technically ended some years ago, it's really a tough economy right now. A lot of people don't have jobs. They're concerned about losing their jobs. And I think people are just watching the dollars real closely.
Well, you can find out more about David Mark and about what's going on in our country by going to politics, politix.com. Thank you, David, and let's talk again soon.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. We'll be back tomorrow. Among our guests, Polite Stewart. He's the child prodigy who went to Southern University, could have gone to many schools in the U.S., but he stayed home and he's graduating. He was with us when he first enrolled at Southern, and he'll be with us tomorrow on this program. For Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.